My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is a series on morality in U.S. society today. We've taken a number of topics through this week and used each topic to come at or to analyze the state of affairs in U.S. society from a moral point of view. We continue that today with the topic, What Happened to Traditional Values? And then after today, we're going to make a switch. And tomorrow evening is entitled something like How Now Community. That is to say, we're going to pose the question, what constructively do we do to firm up the moral fiber of this society? And we're going to be looking to the roles and tasks of the churches in particular. Now, everybody's got an opinion about what happened to traditional value. That means that I don't need to spend time in this session doing a kind of exposition of materials when I've drawn upon particular persons, and you need to know what those particular persons are saying. So this time around, the format will be about a 5-minute introduction, and then discussion among all of us. Please, those of you who are at the edges here, either the edges of my sight or at the edges of the room, the balcony and so on, if I don't see your hand, just simply speak up. And then I want to reserve about 10 minutes at the very end to try to pull some of the strands of the discussion together in such a way that they relate to this subject of what the state of affairs is with especially those communities, families, churches, neighborhoods, schools that have the formation of human character and conscience as a part of their vocation, if you will. Now, let me begin then by reading to you what I've put on the board just so that whether or not you can see it, you know what is up there. Usually, and at least in common conversation, traditional values, Judeo-Christian values, and family values are all used in a cluster together or interchangeably. And no one ever made a list and checked it out with you all or with the rest of us as to just exactly what belonged to traditional values. My guess is that if you went from one community, especially from one racial or ethnic community or one class to another, you might get a different list. But there is a reason why a certain cluster of values turn up in references to traditional values, Judeo-Christian values, and family values. And I'm going to get into that in this introduction. But let me just read you the cluster. You may want to change it. This is not canonized anywhere. Thrift, honesty, frugality, hard work, discipline, deferred gratification.
Whoa.
What happened to traditional values? Avoidance of wastefulness. You save everything. You reuse everything that can be reused. You avoid wasting. I didn't put up there avoidance of excess, but it's in the same league. Marital, family, and community, fidelity or loyalty, sacrifice, prudence. This one isn't a value. Pay as you go. It's a kind of way of doing things. You don't spend what you don't got. Self-reliance. Charity, often in the form of tithing, being quite specific about saving giving a certain amount away. And moral responsibility, and for the sake of the Lutherans and Calvinists, I put guilt there, not because it's a value, but because there's a strong sense of moral responsibility, the failure of which to fulfill leaves one with a sense of guilt that you need then to work off with a little more moral responsibility. Garrison Keillor says about the Lutherans that this business of guilt is quite wonderful because it's the gift that keeps on giving. All right.
a
quick introduction to this. I'm always hesitant to talk about the Judeo-Christian heritage, mostly because Jews don't have one. It's only Christians that have a Judeo-Christian heritage. And I'm not, if I were a Jew, I would have a little problem with someone talking about my values as Judeo-Christian values and my heritage as a Judeo-Christian heritage. But that aside, we can talk about this in terms of a community of Christians. Where do we relate this to the U.S. society at the present? Well, I'm going to start and stop with the 1980s because the appeal, primarily by conservatives and neoconservatives, but also by liberals as well, to traditional values, family values, Judeo-Christian values, was a common appeal, especially when it comes around election time. These things always show up because they have some kind of drawing power. There's some kind of moral capital in this cluster of values, at least in its appeal. And in the 1980s especially, traditional values, Judeo-Christian values, family values were invoked in an effort to restore moral order and collective public purpose to a society that was said to be suffering malaise. The appeal was to these values. Now, where did these values come from? If they're used interchangeably and refer to something like this cluster, it's because they have a situatedness in a particular piece of history that has been very influential in our society, namely the Protestant ethic. And the Protestant ethic was an enormous boost to the establishment of both democracy and capitalism. The Protestant ethic was a different way of talking about the bourgeois ethic, in especially its Reformation forms. That's not the whole of the bourgeois ethic, but the Reformation gave rise to the Protestant ethic, which is not a synonym at all for the capitalist ethic, but the spirit of Protestantism fed into that which was needed and valued for the establishment of the new economy, capitalism. What did capitalism need to get started? Capital, right? Accumulation of capital. How do you get that? You have folks who will work hard and save, but defer gratification, don't spend, who are willing to sacrifice, who defer material and sensual pleasures, who don't drink up all the money that they made during the week, who are disciplined. So this was exactly the kind of set of values. Where did that come from? Part of it, a famous thesis by Max Weber, is that there was a major transition from medieval notion of the Christian life to the Reformation, Lutheran and Calvinist, also Anabaptist notions of the Christian life. It was a switch from otherworldly asceticism to innerworldly asceticism. So that ascetic values, discipline, hard work, frugality, deferred gratification, were no longer focused in the life of monks and nuns, in the monasteries and in a life of prayer. They went to the common folks who saw in the world the place of their service and responsibility before God. It was just plain lay folk who got religion and expressed it in these values. Nothing could have been better for the establishment of capitalism. Now, it doesn't last well. That's a question for you to answer. Okay. The only other thing, and then we're done here with this introduction. Well, maybe two more things. The traditional values have traditionally meant, as have family values, a distinction between a domestic or private sphere and a public sphere in society. And the former, the domestic or private sphere, chiefly home, school, church, was, among other things, led by women's energies and sensibilities. And what the domestic sphere was to do was to affect those virtues which the market, the new economy, capitalism, of itself did not promote or sustain. So you were supposed to have a kinder and gentler morality in home, school, church, that would temper the rough and tumble life that the competition of the marketplace and the politicking of governance involved. So you had a division of labor between a domestic and a public, or private and public sphere, and the family values were sort of to humanize the folks who wouldn't actually be able to express those same values in the rough and tumble world of business and ruling. All right, I think the last... no, that's enough. What happened to traditional values? Are they still around? They were called forth again in the most recent election campaign. Heard lots about traditional family values. Heard lots of controversy about traditional family values, by way of, especially of the vice president at the time. Do they exist? If they don't exist, why don't they exist? What is the appeal of these values? I was sure everybody had an opinion.
They're out there.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe we could look at the change in family structure as looking at it as a cause or an effect of traditional family values, and whether the changing family structure caused such values to be lost, or whether the changing family structure was a result of.
What's the reference you're making to changing family structures, and what is being...
What's the change?
To a higher percentage of single-parent households,
mm-hmm.
higher percentage of divorce, of marriages that are failing, of children now who have four sets of parents. What sort of effects those are having, and was that the start of... I guess it's mostly this generation, or maybe the one just prior to it, that we started seeing such an increase.
And what is your speculation, Rick, about the relationship to these values?
I was posing a question to
yeah.
him, not knowing whether it was an effect or a cause.
Yeah. I'll just comment that families, structure of families, has been in transition since the rise of capitalism. But you're right that, I mean, it's a big change from pre-capitalist to capitalist society. What we call the nuclear family wasn't the nuclear family through most of history. And the extended family became so extended that members were spread all over the place rather than, and the family was no longer the chief economic unit either. So the family has been in transition for quite a long time now. But you're right that the rates of divorce and the numbers of single parent head of household, that has escalated quite rapidly in the last quarter century. Yeah. Other people to this question about a family want to pursue it just a little bit.
Well, it's the women's lib movement, I think, that started. When women started going out into the marketplace, working outside the home, then they could get a divorce. They could support themselves if they didn't want to stay married. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the divorce rate that went up at once.
We should say something to this. I don't want people to lose the connection to what connection is there to the values. But I want to say that first, that initially men left the home with the rise of the new economy. And now more and more women are doing that as well. It isn't that women stayed home, and women and men stayed home. That was the difference from before. Yeah?
Is it appropriate to ask to what extent all of those values are in fact traditional, and to what extent we want to gain them back?
Sure.
I mean, is the assumption that we somehow want to get back to all of this?
I'm not assuming that. My remark was simply to say that for some reason they have some kind of resonance. But as a professor of ethics, I never assume that a description of something is also a normative statement about its desirability.
But it does appear that the notion is, these are traditional values, and whatever went wrong is we don't have them, and we've got to go back.
Yeah. Which ones do you not want to go back to?
Let's take the question first about what traditional, because I think that's interesting. I wondered about that same thing. We're picking traditional based on a certain point in time, and I think you're talking about maybe Reformation, Protestantism, you know, wherever these things kind of. Before that, what was traditional?
Oh, my word.
I mean, is that what hedonism, or what? What was out there before?
Well, I mean, the reference to, in terms of Christian notions of the good life, or Christian notions of the Christian moral life.
But there were many.
The normative vision was the one that I mentioned as innerworldly asceticism. It was a life of contemplation filled out with a certain set of virtues that had to do with.
So those were still there, and
But with the Reformation, the shift is the Christian life is shifts from contemplation to action. But many of the same values and virtues simply shift the scene from religious orders to the life of the laity.
So what are you saying, the life of the laity?
That's what she said.
In medieval
about.
Time, what, I mean, didn't they still have, well, did they, I'm trying to think, you're talking about community, monastic community living versus lay people once you have Reformation. What about all these lay people before the Reformation?
Yeah.
I think we could talk about them. What I'm anxious for us not to do is to move away from their reference in this society, which has very little to do with the medieval set of traditional values. It has to do with the impact in this society, in its cultural formation, which is heavily impacted by the confluence of the Protestant temper with capitalist economics. So I'd like to, for the sake of discussion, not push tradition back farther than that. Mark, and then Deanne.
Well, I think if you talk about the 80s and what happened, is that that the conservatives and neoconservatives made a division where you took a division between the family and the larger society, and they applied traditional values only in the sphere, the domestic or the private sphere, because in the public sphere where they were conservatives on the family side and liberals on the, that is, the logic of the market is contrary to almost every one of those values.
Huh.
Certainly deferred gratification, hard work, thrift, honesty, frugality, any of those things don't work in a market economy. And so it's, I think they can they manage this by bifurcating society, and the liberals happen to do it the other way around. They have a liberal notion of the so-called social sphere and a conservative notion of the economic sphere. But I mean, it strikes me that's what's happening.
But you were saying that bifurcation happened clear back.
Yeah, but it continues. But in the 1980s, it's clearly appealed to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Deanne and then Hans.
At the risk of doing what you asked us not to do, namely push it back, I do think there have been a bunch of bifurcations that have taken place. And the one that you alluded to by talking about women's energy and social reform is indicative of a very important one. Namely, that as the Industrial Revolution, et cetera, took place, and men left the home to do work outside of the home, so workplace and living space were separated, the traditional Christian values, if you will, of things like humility, self-sacrifice, service to others, were assigned to women.
Ah.
And that men could do other things. You know, men out in the cruel, dirty world had to be proud and aggressive, but women then were responsible for being humble and meek. And that this notion that women then provided a sort of refuge from the dirty world, where men could return after they've got to undo this and it's necessary for survival, also gave rise then to women's efforts to reform society. Say, well, if these are good values for the home, then if we get the vote, we'll use those good values and fix the rest, so to expand the notion of the home. And it seems to me that we're still struggling with that a little bit, with more than one set of what's good. And we're never quite sure which set to apply where. It's like there are different rules for different games.
Mm-hmm.
There are different values.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be getting ahead in the corporate structure, you need a certain set of values. And those may not require the same virtues that you're learning about in these communities that you've been talking
mm-hmm.
about, from which we expect moral formation. So it's as if you're prepared to, with one set of values, and then you go play a different game. No, it's like what happened to me in elementary school. I had a PE teacher who let us catch the volleyball. Consequently, I am absolutely terrible volleyball player because my reflex is that I'm allowed to catch it. And it doesn't work.
And so what is your conclusion about what values, for example, belong in one sphere that don't work in another?
Well, I think things like humility.
Yeah, it doesn't work real well.
It doesn't work very well in interdependence. You know, if Christianity tells us we should be interdependent, but the self-help rack is full of books about codependence as a bad thing, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Hans and then Carol, and then back here. Hans?
Okay, what Mark was saying about the bifurcation between certain sets of values which were still appealed to in the 80s made me, and then in the public sphere other values were enforced, made me think of another way of picking this up, and that is looking at it from the point of view of a smaller community, like a town of 10,000 or 15,000, where there's a network of community obligations and givings and takings which still determine certain sets of conscience over against ripping somebody off. Whereas in a larger community where people don't know each other anymore, where the capacities that our technological society give people much more permission to rip each other off. That distinction, I think, is illuminating for me. And so I would say that the smaller community, not that it's a virtue in itself, this tends to marginalize the people who rip other people off. Everybody in town knows so-and-so is a shyster. And the people who are involved with criminality are the truckers and so on. Whereas in a larger community, you build networks of certain people you can trust in the public sphere. So-and-so is a reliable auto dealer, and so on. And then beyond that, you have to really watch out, because the large corporations, the impersonal operations, the telephone networks, where you keep getting calls trying to sell you things, the huge realm of the stock market, where the little person gets gobbled up, that's way beyond us, and it's beyond any sense of personal accountability vis-a-vis somebody else. So I want to put my finger on the technology and on networks of interpersonal responsibility, which we can still monitor.
And these values are more present there relative to the world of anonymity of large metropolitan areas.
Yes. And I think the impersonality and the technology tend to erode those values because something else drives life, either personal greed or corporate greed.
Carol, back here, Linda, and here.
I was just going to say that I got to thinking about how which one of these values is really being tried out again, or we're trying to get back from. And it seems to me thrift is one of the ones that we keep hearing about. We've got to cut our spending, you know, and how hard it is to go back to what is considered a traditional value and that we've sort of done away with for a while. And now everybody's saying we've got to tighten our belts, we've got to cut spending. It's really difficult to go backwards.
It's like we have to start spending, consume more.
Yeah.
We're getting mixed messages here. We're trying to get things back to more getting and spending.
Yeah.
But we may have to be thrifty for a while. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Kurt.
Okay.
Thank you. I guess addressing a combination of things, if I can go back. First of all, I think it's important in the marketplace, being in the marketplace, that we retain these values or many of these values. It's not necessarily true that they are retained, but some of the more successful and people that I know in the marketplace, and ones obviously that I admire, are ones that do carry this over into the marketplace. And it's actually a successful managerial style where humility comes into play, that it's less of a boss employee managerial style that's now successful, and it's going towards more of a mentor student type relationship. And it in many successful companies, and some companies are experimenting with this, and many are very, very good at it, it is becoming more of a interpersonal type managerial style. So I think it's important that be drawn into as much as we can into the marketplace. But we have a long way to go. I think in morality becomes an advantage and becomes environment that is successful for the individual and for the company as well.
And which of the traditional values are most appealing for that?
Well, I haven't really set in my mind, I guess, what the priorities would be or which ones, but I guess in a broad sense, just many of the values that are listed here, certainly honesty and frugality, hard work, discipline, would obviously go there. And I think that there's a certain balance, at least in the some of the companies that I'm familiar with, that when family comes into the workplace, it gains a real positive influence for the people working there, that kids periodically come into the offices, and that changes the character of an office, and it's good for the office.
What is the purpose of that?
Of children coming in?
No, reintroducing some of the traditional values that you spoke of into the workplace.
Well, I think there's many reasons for that or objectives for that. One, I think the, in large part, what led to or to the fragmentation of family life and values is the lack of time with family, and the difference between home life and the marketplace, as you're referring to. There was such a disparity there that it was hard to communicate. There was too much difference between the two areas, and so I think it's important to have that those values broad reaching through everything that we do throughout our whole day. We don't go to work and be one person and go home and be another.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Let me go first to people who haven't spoken and then come back. Please.
You have no other people in front of me. I'm the one.
I think the two that I saw, at least, have spoken once before. That's why.
Okay. Well, I.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, Linda. Yeah. Linda, you go ahead because you were first.
I wanted to address two different issues. One of them is Hansen's comments. I think one of the most striking things right now is that we have this illusion, the small town illusion, the suburban community church illusion, the going to the mountain place in the summer illusion of this for what you talked about yesterday in terms of manifold connectedness. Mm-hmm. Kind of like it, you know. We could all just live in towns of 15,000. It would be fine. We could all just, you know, leave our horrible jobs and that we have all year long and go to the mountains, a place where we have to pump water and burn in the fireplace, and burn not ourselves in the fireplace, burn stuff in the fireplace. That and in fact, the reality of the global economy is such that it is virtually impossible to be disconnected from the global forces that are working around us right now. That, and it isn't even like there's sort of bad people in Wall Street or something, and nothing else. There are bad people in Wall Street and Tokyo and London and wherever else all of these things are that are churning out money to do things and production, and this commoditized thing affects everyone because there's no way that economy for the 15,000 people exists apart from the world economy at this point. There's literally no way it can be done. I two book readings that I've done came out. Remember, Habit of the Heart talks about this. They talk about this sort of suburban illusion where, you know, you're sort of here, and then it turns out the car dealership guy who's been the top small town community values guy and no regulation suddenly is the Chrysler dealership guy who wants the United States government to give a loan to
bail out Chrysler, yeah.
And right now I'm reading a book called Dakota, the Antelope Queen. And here you've got these small rural towns in West Dakotas, in West Dakota as opposed to the East Dakota, never mind North or South, these little teeny towns who are just being blown apart by the world economy. And people are refusing to look at it because their small town interconnections with one another seem like enough, and they can't even hear the voice that comes in from the outside to say, look, it can't keep going on this way, this other world is there. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that. It doesn't have a conclusion about it.
It sounds like
somehow this piece of it, and the third one, I guess, is the one, these people who go to the mountains in the summer. I find it really interesting. The way we deal with it at some level is to bring ourselves individually some wholeness.
Sounds like the conclusion is that the larger economic dynamics so affect all of us that whatever values are flow in their wake also affect all of us, whether in large metropolitan areas, suburbs, small towns.
And I guess maybe if I did have a conclusion out of it, it would be, I think maybe there's important wholeness to be gained by trying to hold on to them in our little ways. I don't mean to dismiss that. I think, you know, we all gain some.
But then there's a tension.
Being here, you know, where we see the person who runs the thing when we don't otherwise. And I think there's that, I think that's good, and it sort of keeps us intact, but I don't think that it's, it also has a kind of a romantic aspect or something to it that's hard to catch. And in response to you, I got a response to your question to him, which is the reason that the workplace is changing is because the old structure wasn't working. If you're going to be profitable, you've got to somehow make some non-hierarchical work relationships. It's not like they're doing it because they've suddenly got religion.
Family values.
Family values, not, it's good business rather than family values. Right. That's the motivation there. Yeah.
Well, I want to add a couple of values to your list.
Yeah.
But before that, I want to make a couple points. One of them is that the Judeo-Christian tradition is really rooted not in capitalism but in pastoralism. People who herded goats and sheep, and that tradition is essentially an acquisitive tradition. I mean, it includes prize price and seeing how many animals you can raise and how much wealth you can accumulate. And pastoralists are no pikers at having problems with moral dilemmas. And Genghis Khan supposedly tried to completely depopulate Western China, and in studies of the best guess is that he killed 40 million Chinese peasants. And the values that you've placed up there are primarily values that have to do with acquisition, maintenance of capital, which predate the Industrial Revolution, many of them. Some of them have come before since then. So I think one of the things I would have you do is look not only just at the recent Christian problem with values, but look at the Christian problems with values ever since it became the imperial religion of military state, and look at the Judeo values that caused problems that were essentially pastoral in nature. You know, before it was involved in a large imperial state, it was just involved in a local military state structure in the Middle East. But anyway, I would really like to add some values that still are family values that predate pastoralism to your list.
For example,
the central family value in a hunter-gatherer society is equity, equality, and sharing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get into an incredible, massive community fight if the distribution of food products isn't done scrupulously, honestly, and fairly, and equally. And the center of their religious rituals and practices and faith is interpersonal healing. The concept that you can be healed by your mother or your father or your brother or some immediate kin that, you know, lays hands on you and puts energy into you. But they have a whole series of values that sort of predate the ones that are based on, you know, how to get and maintain wealth that have almost completely died out of Western cultures. And I would be extremely, I guess, let me conclude by, I don't think anything new is happening here. I think our values have been under stress, and the homicide rate and child abuse rates and almost everything else are going up recently, but our Judeo-Christian culture has been under stress before. There have been many periods in the past where, you know, mass migrations have taken place and where there have been incredible dislocations and massive genocide and warfare. And in all of those periods of time, incidences, all kinds of family violence increased, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. All kinds of public violence increased. And there's a strong relationship, statistical relationship, between public violence and family violence within recent society. So I doubt seriously that, I mean, I think we're essentially continuing along the same thing. We're just in a period of decline, stress, economically in the United States, and it's bringing some of these issues to the fore, and people are, but in any event, let me conclude by saying I think the real, that the real values that are going to either bring community or solution to the current crisis predate Christ by several thousands of years, need to be added to that.
That's the topic for tomorrow night, when we talk in a more normative sense about what we think is now viable moral community. The reference up here is primarily to the appeal using this kind of language in the United States.
Well, they just want us to get back to work. They, I mean, it's pure and simple that.
I've got a watcher on here. Okay, go ahead.
You made a statement earlier about ethics being reintroduced into the workplace, which seems to imply no ethics in the workplace. I disagree with that.
I don't think anyone said no ethics in the workplace. Ethics are everywhere.
Yeah. Somebody said reintroducing ethics into the workplace earlier.
Right. Yeah, and instead of meaning different values to replace the ones that were there.
I think there's some distinction here between restructuring how a company works to make it more efficient to compete in a different environment and the ethics that have been there all along. I think what we see quite often in our press are examples of companies where ethics have been shoved aside and they become very negative images of capitalism. Mm-hmm. I believe there are a lot of good, solid companies where those ethics are the heart of the business.
Mm-hmm.
They are the structure around which that company operates, but companies like people make mistakes. We're sinful.
So
I don't think that it is so much that the greed is the only motivating force and that these are shoved aside in order to pull in the almighty dollar. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Anne?
I guess I want to go back a little bit to this discussion of the 80s and the election discussion about family values and point to two real sources of hypocrisy in that discussion. One is that we have a long history of electing and putting into positions of leadership and prominence people who have very muddy family values backgrounds, people with mistresses and connections to the mafia and long histories of, you know, various kinds of business, unethical business dealings. I mean, that as long as those things, it seems, were kept apart, either in the seclusion of their unhappy home or somehow kept under wraps by a cooperative group of fellow business persons or politicians or a co-opted press, that was fine. We could believe in them and their leadership, and their values failures were not revealed to anyone, and we happily accepted them as leaders. Another quadrant of that is our willingness, even in the height of Dan Quayle's outburst, to allow celebrities of all sorts, political and show business, entertainment people and leaders, to live lives that are very much in opposition to this, I mean, very exorbitant Donald Trump type spending, and it's sort of a double, what's that word for a double standard? Where people who could like Donald Trump and those people who could live that way didn't have to keep any of these rules. The same as the robber barons in the earlier century. They didn't have to have these kinds of values, but everyone else does, especially women and families.
Yes.
You know, I think that, you know, looking at some of the things that happened during the 80s as far as political campaigns and so forth that you were speaking of, and I think there was an element of creating fear in people at that particular point to, you know, give the candidate an edge, of course. But I think that these were pointed out, these descriptors that you've given of traditional values, were pointed out as those are the things we want to reinstitute. We want to go back to the 1950s. quote-unquote. Mm. The 1950s weren't that cool, as you probably remember. Mm. They weren't. The only thing that was probably good about them is people felt secure, people felt comfortable, but the world has changed. The media has changed. Our information sources have changed significantly to the point where if we don't like something that's happening, we can say it's an erosion of traditional values.
Yeah.
And I don't think that there's so much an erosion of traditional values, because I think there's still a cadre of people that believe in those traditional values. But there are other societal influences from other countries, other mores, other religions that permeate us, and we get fearful. Mm. And the best way to win an election is to scare the socks off the people and tell them what's wrong. Mm. They had no way of correcting it. Mm. But I think it's something that we have to, in our own minds, be prepared to accept that the world is changing, and we're going to have to do some changing with it, but yet maintain our own personal identities.
So these values are kind of, in a political campaign, represent good news in that they represent echoes of a secure, stable culture in
right,
which people
because
do
you're
their
familiar
way,
with those and
do their way around. Mike and Jan, and then Keith.
Yeah, a couple things. In thinking about going back to the 50s, I think about the 60s as a revolutionary time, and that if there was a reaction against what happened in the 60s and some of the values people espoused in the 60s. And so I think part of the appeal of returning to traditional values is rejecting the 60s. Mm. And I'm not sure if you're rejecting sexual liberation or drug use or something like that. I'm not sure that I see that exactly up here. So that it's rejecting something alien, but it may not be expressed in what you have on the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also have a question in the sense for the people defending American business. And I'm not sure I'm not sure exactly how this works, but it strikes me that when we have corporations saying quality is job one, that what they're saying is we forgot about quality at some point. And I don't think they're saying we were, you know, dishonest or undisciplined, or didn't, you know, they aren't saying we gave up on these values, but somehow we weren't competing in this one area and some others got the jump on us. And we've got to get back at doing that better. Mm. And I'm not sure how if traditional values fit into that or not.
Yeah. Jan?
As these novels became solidified in 18th and 19th century England, they were at the core of what George Eliot writes about in her novels. And she's describing in, for example, The Mill on the Floss, families who were closely connected to the evangelicalism in that setting. Mm-hmm. And she portrays how these very values can support the family in such a way that the outcome is capitalist success.
Mm-hmm.
So that this bifurcation we were talking about earlier exists, but it really comes together in the fact that these are the very values that support both, let's say, goodness in the home, mm-hmm. if you want to describe it that way, and success in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. The two absolutely go together, but the right hand doesn't know what the left hand mm-hmm. is doing, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that she shows that these values can be the most stultifying,
mm-hmm.
as well as having the possibility for growth. In other words, they aren't, as you were saying earlier, good in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on what happens to
mm-hmm.
them. And the second part of that, I'd really like to hear from the youngest generation represented in this room, because I hear my own children saying from time to time that some of these values are the ones with which they were raised in one form or another, but they don't pay off in the world today.
Mm.
I'd like to hear what some of the young people here think about that.
Yeah. let's put that as a question. Keith, I'll take your comment, but put that as a question out here for people to be thinking about. And
my
hear from
I can't answer the question.
No, you don't represent that generation yet.
But what strikes me is that there's a parallel, or maybe even there's a way in which one could think of this from a moral point of view that is really a change in identifications. For instance, it strikes me that one of the things in the business world is a real change from an identification with the company or one's career as part of what one takes on, and therefore the provision of quality, the sense that it's a duty. You don't just, you know, ripping off is not something one does when you consider what you're doing as work, as some kind of call in your career. It's unthinkable. But when you're just the cog in the machine, you only see a part of it. You did what you're supposed to do. If it doesn't work out, it's not your responsibility. Mm-hmm. Or in public life, when politicians thought that their duty is to the public good, in a way, the notion of lying to the populace as a perfectly acceptable way to carry on the public discourse is much less palatable. So it strikes me that a lot of these things that we think of as the loss of values or these sort of individualistic values are what happens when the only identification I can have is with me. Mm. I can't identify with this larger role that I play in society. And it reminds me of someone who was here home not too long ago who was saying that one of the things which helps in this new world is the possibility of Christians identifying in some sense what they're doing as a servant ministry, where you don't depend on either identifying with a company per se or with just your own narrow self-interest. Mm-hmm. You can still be an actor who carries values that we find valuable and treats people in ways that are respectful of them, despite all the competition and despite all that stuff. And that you don't necessarily find the payoff is entirely in terms of worldly success. So you don't, that's not the only good out there. Whereas what I think some of the younger generation might be saying, this is pure projection, is that it doesn't pay off, and if you don't win, you don't get promoted, you get used, you get laid off when the company's done with you, etc. And that jobs change, and your modernity says, well, that computer company is no longer, they're not on top of it anymore, and everybody's out of work. But it doesn't destroy you, and you don't have to treat people as though they're, it's a zero-sum game.
I'd like to hear from generation moving now into full citizen participation in the society. You know, your education is pretty well taken care of. You're looking to jobs, or you're in jobs, but you represent a younger generation than the folks who have been talking. Most of them. And where and what kind of attraction or not, what kind of how realistic or not are such values as these?
I think one factor that with our generation is we grew up with television. We're the first, and I just especially and even doing babysitting, seeing a kid. I mean, the whole idea of the television is the babysitter now, and most of all with the commercials. We talk about what's set in front of us is buy this, you need this, you need this. And that's just how we grew up. And so when you talk about things like deferred gratification, I think we really grew up capitalism right in front of us in television. I think that's one factor that but as far as going out into the workplace, I think family values are still, they were present growing up with us, and the There's a there, and we also, I think another thing is we also grew up, you know, with a certain, you were talking about politics and such, you know, in the 60s, with the sort of losing the disenchantment with the government. We grew up after that, you know, that the world isn't such a safe, secure place in the 50s, perhaps. We don't trust the government as much. So I think those are some factors.
Yeah, thanks. Others, please.
I think for myself, I just came out of college and just went through the whole job process. And I mean, I identify with all those values as for myself, but I feel that I am in a minority. And even if I feel very genuine as a person and I have all these qualities, when you're sending out my, whatever, 200 applications that I sent out for teaching jobs, they really don't care, you know. You're just kind of lost in this sea, and there's so many people that feel they're forced to lie or, you know, do whatever it takes in order to get a job, and I think that all ties in with, you know, what is expected and, you know, how these values just aren't honored as much. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going, but I just also wanted to add that I'm teaching in a very rural area, and even though it's not the big city, I'm still finding that same breakdown in values. And even though it's a very secluded area, farms distance from each other, I see the same thing in my kids that I teach at school. And part of that, I think, is the separation of the family, many children that are raised with this person or that person or grandparent, grandma now and dad later, and, you know, don't have that stability that I think is important in nurturing children when they're young. But I don't know. I think it's not as clear cut as that, and I think that I see it in older generations also, not just my generation. Mm-hmm. I think that I've seen that also.
Yeah, thanks.